Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back, and happy Boxing Day to you, and Merry Christmas, and let's have a little more fun this hour. Lighten things up a little bit. It's the season. People maybe are off today. I hope you're off today, or maybe you're on, and you joined us while you're working. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate that you join us, but let's have a little fun with Trent Horn for the Christmas season. Is that all right with you, Trent, if we have fun at your expense? No, it won't be at your expense.
It will just be with my expense. You'll have, you know, say, we're not laughing at you. We're laughing with you. I'm not laughing. Well, you should be.
Yes, that was actually our plan. You've ruined it now, but that's what we were about to do.
All right, let's do it.
We're going to take questions from your patrons. But first, Edgar has this thing he likes to do where he plays a clip that he finds on the internet. And I'm probably supposed to know more about it, like YouTube or where on the, is it YouTube? Do you care if I know? It is YouTube. All right. And then he plays it, and then he gets our reaction to it.
Okay.
And he's been doing this on this thing we call the Super Show, which is a show we do before the show on the internet. But we're going to do it live now with you on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll do it live.
Are you going to
do it live?
You will just do it live.
Do it live.
I can't do it. Just we'll do it live.
Dang sucks. Do it live.
At least I got that reference.
Thank you.
Okay, so what are you going to do right now? You going to play a clip for us? And then Trent reacts to it, or I react to it, or what? Trent reacts. Oh, see, we're looking for the reaction of Mr. Trent Horn to the following clip. Go ahead.
All agree that Jar Jar being a Sith has been one of the most popular fan theories around. But is it actually true? Well, there is actually proof that he may be one, and here's how. At one point during the Clone Wars, Jar Jar picked up a lightsaber, and crazy enough, he wielded it confidently and used it pretty well. But that's not all. Not only did he prove he could use a saber, but he's also been able to convince people to do things at the most pivotal moments. The biggest example of this was when he convinced the Senate to give Palpatine emergency powers in Episode 2. Without that, Palpatine would have never had full control, which means there would have been no clone army for the Jedi, which also means no Order 66. In a deleted scene, Palpatine even thanked Jar Jar for giving him these powers, which makes it even more suspicious. Not only that, but George Lucas himself even said that Jar Jar was the key to everything. So with that, do you think he's a Sith Lord?
Trent?
No.
You don't think he's, no. You don't think Jar Jar is a Sith Lord? I don't. Does,
me,
what,
me does, think this theory has holes in it.
There we go. There we go. He did a little Jar Jar for us. I want to make videos like that where you get to talk like this.
He was evil. No doubt. He is a he is not a moral evil. He is a natural evil. So, like a horrible fungus or a bug bite or a hurricane, Jar Jar represented a tremendous natural evil that befell the Star Wars franchise. Or like a baby that throws up on you. You can't get mad at the baby. It's not the baby's fault. You can be annoyed by the vomit on your clothes. And that is Jar Jar Binks.
So Jar Jar is not a Sith, just a material evil.
No, people can use you can use lightsabers if you are trained well enough in that. So, for example, Count Dooku trained General Grievous to be able to lightsaber duel other Jedis. But Grievous is not a Sith Lord. He doesn't have any Force powers. That doesn't prove anything.
You're starting to come across as kind of a nerd now. That was a lot of lore right there.
This is strange for me, Sai, because I am technically what is called a Jedi Vacantist. I don't recognize any of the events that took place after Return of the Jedi as being events that actually happened, though I may make an exception for Rogue One and the Clone Wars cartoon animated series, I should say.
But Rogue not One Solo? Not the movie Solo? You didn't like the movie Solo?
We don't need an explanation for why his name is Han Solo. That can just be his name, along with everything else in it. Now, you know what I would have been okay with, Sai?
What?
A Han Solo movie? That makes me mad. A Lando movie? I could get behind that.
Well, yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of Lando lore.
I'm just going to go agree to disagree on that one. Agree to disagree. How do you get to talk like that guy who made that video? Is there a school for that kind of talking? Do you think Jar Jar is a... What is that? What was he doing? Is that how you talk on YouTube? Are you supposed to talk like... Because I feel I could master that, and I can learn to be a new media star if you had just told me that's how I'm supposed to talk.
I think that's AI, or maybe AI? Jerry Seinfeld having
like
a really
Jerry
bad
Seinfeld
day.
AI. It's not even an IA.
Deal with Jar Jar Binks?
Jar Jar Binks. The guy has a very... Is the next guy going to talk like that? Because it's going to bother me. You can't stop doing it once you start.
Right.
I'm locked in like this. It's like if you cross your eyes and they get stuck like that.
All right.
Go ahead. Give us another one.
Oh, we got another one? All right.
I'm waiting for Edgar.
Have you heard of the Home Alone dad theory? Well, it suggests that Kevin McAllister's father, Peter, might have a mysterious source of wealth, fueling fan speculation. The theory arises from the McAllisters' lavish lifestyle, including their large suburban Chicago home and their ability to fund expensive family vacations, such as their trip to Paris. Some fans theorize that Peter could be involved in the mob or criminal activities, given his unexplained wealth and calmness about leaving Kevin behind. Others speculate about possible insurance fraud, especially considering the burglary at their home. A less common but intriguing angle is that Peter might be a government agent, given the lack of clarity about his job. Let us know your theory in the comments.
Maybe he's a Sith Lord.
There you go.
He's more likely to be a
Sith
Lord.
Let's go to the break.
Did you know in the early 1990s there were wealthy people? Crazy, who had kind of boring jobs.
What?
Crazy. This is the one that people always bring up also, Cy, when they say like, and I do believe housing has become unaffordable.
Housing market has gone insane.
And people will say like, look what Kevin McAllister, the house he could buy with a middle class lifestyle. And it's this lavish, you know, New England home. And it's like, we've been robbed of this. Like, no, this is not a middle class family. You want to know how I know why? Because there are a family in the 1990s who went to Paris for a vacation.
Yeah.
Families of the 1990s, like you didn't travel, the only people who travel international in the 90s were people who could afford to pay for travel agents to get tickets to go and do something like that.
Remember travel agents?
So it's very different. What?
I said, remember travel agents? Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, he's just a rich dude. That's all. Not all rich dudes, it's nefarious. He's probably the CFO of a midsize medical company, and he's got plenty of money. That's what I think.
The simplest explanation is
that guy talks interesting too. Magnificent suburban Chicago home.
No, that guy was a reject from the Dateline auditions. Like, do you want to narrate the Dateline murder mystery show?
Oh yeah.
What he thought was a normal Friday afternoon would become a web of lies and intrigue, that his voice reminded me of a failed Dateline murder mystery voiceover person.
Dateline is one of those shows that if you're watching it and the commercial comes on and you get about two commercials in and somebody says, what are you watching? You can't remember. You're like, I know I'm watching something, but I don't remember what show I'm watching. And then it comes back on. You go, oh yeah, I'm in the middle of a murder mystery. It's amazing how little they penetrate into the mind that you can't even remember what the show is while the commercial is playing.
I wonder if people do that for Catholic Answers Live. We come back, like, what were they talking about? It's something about the Jews. I can't remember.
Are the Jews Sith Lords was the main topic of the first. That would have been a better question for me to open with.
Do the Jews have a conspiracy to rob houses around Christmas and plug up the drains and fill the house with water when they go?
Is that what happened in? I can't remember that.
In Home Alone?
Home Alone. Is that what happened?
The sticky bandits. They're the wet bandits, and they become the sticky bandits. Were Marv and were they Jewish? Probably.
I'm not a huge fan of slapstick. I'm not a huge fan of it. I like it when when Buster Keaton does it, or when Charlie Chaplin does it. But after that, I think they did it. Like, why are we still doing this? I don't really need to see anybody slip on marbles and fall down the stairs. It just doesn't do it.
Slapstick, it gets old, but physical comedy, for example, we have still not reached the heights of physical comedy that Jim Carrey could do in the 1990s.
Well,
he was a living cartoon.
Yeah, he was. And that's why after I saw a Jim Carrey movie, I thought, I'm so glad I saw that. Never have to do that again, though. All right, we'll take a quick break. Right back with Trent Horn. No more conspiracy. I'm having trouble myself. No more conspiracy theories. We're going straight to patron questions when we come back.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN Media Missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
I want to do that voice so bad, but I'm not that good at it. I got to work on my internet YouTube voice. You ready for some patron questions, Trent Horn? Trent Horn's here. It's Christmas. I just actually literally ate a Christmas cookie. I don't know how else you would eat a Christmas cookie. I don't know why I threw the word literally in there. But I guess just to show how Christmassy my tummy is right now. I've got a Christmassy tummy.
You mean sugary and sleepy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and slightly pepperminty. You want to do some patron questions now from your patrons?
Let's do some patron questions. I would be happy to do that.
Patrons are people who make it possible for Trent to keep doing what he's doing, and they are they give to support his work at Council of Trent. You should look up councilofTrent.com. It's CONSELC. Clever. Council of Trent. This one comes from, am I supposed to say the full name?
You can. Some of them, I think, are usernames, so do your best.
Sean Patrick Duffy. That sounds like an actual real person's name. Trent, what are your thoughts on embryo adoption?
This is bad because I really should have more thoughts on this question. Mm-hmm. I'm very torn. I am actually the editor of an anthology on human embryo adoption that was just published by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I'm one of the co-editors of the anthology. So we wrote the opening summary to the book and then organized the book that has probably something like two dozen Catholic authors in it. Jimmy Akin is actually featured in it. He offers an essay on the church's magisterial teaching on human embryo adoption. Just to make it clear that the church does not have a specific teaching at this time on whether it's okay to adopt frozen human embryos who have been discarded to prevent them from just wasting away in cryopreservation. So when we're talking about human embryo adoption, that's what we're talking about in a specific, not in vitro fertilization, but human embryos left in cryopreservation and couples who adopt them solely for the good of those embryos themselves. And our authors, we have some like Father Tad Beholchek say that it is not permissible. It violates the unique duty and role of the husband to impregnate his wife and no one else. Other Catholic philosophers and ethicists and theologians saying it can be permitted for the good of the child. It's a kind of adoption, theology of adoption. Everyone involved is really split down the middle. I've read both sides. I'm still really undecided. So I take more of a practical approach. I think that even if it is permissible, if you start promoting this as a good thing, it will just serve to make people think it's okay to do IVF because the extra embryos will get adopted anyways. So from a strictly pragmatic perspective, I don't support promoting this and would like to see fewer children end up being created through in vitro fertilization. I certainly mourn those who suffer from infertility, but the inhuman things that occur when children are created outside of the safety of the womb, where they are deliberately killed in IVF labs, left in cryopreservation and storage, where they could have significant health outcomes that we're not even familiar with now as a result of being through the process of IVF. These are just other things that really need to be considered, and that children ultimately, as the church says, no one has a right to a child. A child is a gift. It is a gift from God that we lovingly accept, and it is not right for us to create children outside of the marital act.
Thanks very much, Sean. I hope that that answer addressed, it certainly seems like it did, but I hope it did address what you were looking for. Let's go to another patron question. Joseph Daly is a patron of the Trent Horn podcast, Council of Trent. What do you think is the best argument, Joseph asks, against utilitarianism? And what are some good resources to refute this normative theory? What book or resource do you think provides the best defense of natural law ethics?
Charles Rice, a while back, did a book, 50 Questions on Natural Law. And by the way, I would say that natural law, and there's different schools of thought of natural law. Robert George is a proponent of the new natural law theory. You can get his books on that. Someone like Ed Fazer might be more of what you would call kind of an older traditional natural law school theorist. And both have their place within Catholic moral philosophy and theology. But you could also, even if you don't believe in natural law theory, your philosophers are not in favor of that. It doesn't follow that you should be a utilitarian. There's many other ethical theories that are out there. I think that the biggest objection to utilitarianism is that it has a misplacing of ultimate value. Utilitarian, and there's different, by the way, there's different kinds of utilitarianism as well. What the questioner is probably thinking of is act utilitarianism. This is the idea that an act is moral. An action is moral if it produces more utility than another act. And usually utility is defined in terms of well-being. Like, does it produce more well-being? Does it cause less harm? A sloppy way of doing it is to say that utilitarians believe in the maximum amount of pleasure for the greatest number of people, which those are two competing things, by the way. If you try to put it that way, it leads to all kinds of crazy. You can't do that, right? Because let's say you could increase so there's lots of people and lower happiness until it gets to a bare minimum amount. So everyone's just barely willing to live, but there's zillions of people. Or if you say, well, I want to have a society where it's the average amount of happiness is the highest. Well, then we should kill this guy if he's sad, and that will increase the average. You know, there's all kinds of problems here. It misplaces the ultimate value in being in well-being and pleasure versus just persons themselves as being intrinsic sources of value. And the best way to show the problems of utilitarianism is just to show, when brought to its logical conclusions, utilitarianism leads to repugnant, immoral conclusions. It just does not account for our basic moral intuitions that we have that we can be very certain of that are true. I used to always do these thought experiments of you getting killed with abortion. I guess we can...
Skip.
I have to. I'm going to have to.
Here we go.
I'm going to. It's going to be worse, Cy.
Yeah, go ahead.
This time, so for example, here's something utilitarianism cannot.
All right.
You know, so let's say Cy, he's no longer, people are a fan of him as a host of Catholic Answers Live. And
so we're talking about 5 years ago.
Right. He gets fired and he wanders the streets and is mm-hmm. homeless and mm-hmm. has no friends or family anymore, stumbles into a hospital. And then the doctors realize he's unconscious. Oh, we could save his life. Or wait, 5 of his organs would save 5 healthy, beloved individuals of the Catholic Answers Apologetics team. Well, utilitarianism would say that what would produce the most utility is to carve up Psy, so that the other 5 members of the Catholic Answers Apologetics team and family can go on to have happy, productive lives. There's more utility there. So you could sacrifice people. Here's another one. This is another fun one. So another one where this one involves Cy and his twin brother, Guy.
Why do you say this we'll is another this... fun one? That first one wasn't fun. I didn't have fun with that thing.
Well, Cy and Guy are twin joggers, and Bob is a neighbor to them.
Yeah.
And Bob really cannot stand Cy and Guy jogging past his house every day.
All right.
One day, Bob backs out of his house and he accidentally runs over Guy. And he's like, oh, I can't believe that happened. Then the next day he thinks, I really can't stand that other jogger, Cy. And here he comes running by. You know, he's going to come running by any soon. I really hope when I back out my car right now, I accidentally run over him as well. Okay. Now, if utilitarianism is true, both of these acts are either equally right or equally wrong. Okay. Because they cause the same utility, the death of a person.
Right.
But notice the intentions are very different here. In one case, you would say, well, he's a bad guy, but what he did wasn't wrong because, you know, it was an accident. Mm-hmm. But if you say it's wrong because he caused, if it's wrong to back over Cy because he hoped for that to happen and it causes negative utility, then it's wrong to accidentally do it. So you can't take things that don't cause negative utility, like just evil thoughts a person may have, and say that those are evil. And then there's lots of other examples. Utilitarianism is a hard time explaining why we have special obligations to our own family members instead of to other people if utility is all that matters. When it comes to books on this, I would say Carol Wojtyła, the future Pope John Paul II, his book Love and Responsibility has a good section on utilitarianism, and Alistair MacIntyre's book After Virtue also has good critiques of utilitarianism. But even the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy will show you many formidable objections to utilitarianism, to act utilitarianism. That's why a lot of these guys will say, well, we're rule utilitarians. So we just follow rules that end up producing the most utility, which either makes you more of a traditional deontologist, rule-based person, or you end up having to break the rules in an emergency situation anyways, and it becomes just kind of incoherent. But that's a little bit on utilitarianism there.
Joseph, thank you. That was actually kind of nostalgic. A little trip down memory lane, Trent finding various ways to kill me on the air.
Careful when you jog down memory lane, Cy.
I know. You never know. Bob. Keep an eye out for Bob. I got time for another one before we have to take a break. These are questions from Trent's patrons, Mario Rosas. Hi, Trent.
Hello.
Oh, there you go. Mario said, hi, Trent.
Hello, Mario.
All right. Yeah. How do I approach a friend who believes many of our dogmas, but feels like he's growing spiritually in his charismatic church, so he feels no need to change?
I would just ask him, what advice would you give to someone who you would want to join your charismatic church, but feels like they are growing spiritually in a non-Christian religion? So let's say you're friends with a Mormon, and you say, oh, you know, why don't you come to my church and, you know, be baptized and worship Jesus? And the Mormon says, I'm interested, but I'm just growing so much in, I'm growing so much here in the Mormon church. What would you say to him? I'm sure the charismatic guy will point out, oh, well, here's problems in moral theology. That even if you're growing in certain fruits of the spirit and certain virtue, well, you're growing in certain virtues, for example, you're still missing very important things that God wants you to have. So at least for that guy, I tell him, hey, you would tell a non-Christian, even if they're growing in virtue, there's important things they're missing out on in the church, the Christian church, what you think is the true church. You would ask, Mario, you could ask your friend, do you believe Christians should belong to the church, whatever that is? What if I were to tell you, it's like the Matrix, red pill, blue pill. What if I were to tell you that the church is not just an invisible confederation or loose-knit invisible collection of all Christians, but that it has a visible enduring hierarchy that can guide us as believers to salvation through the administering of the sacraments, and that other Christians might be connected to this church, say Protestants, for example, in imperfect ways, but we desire for all Christians to be in perfect communion with the one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church that Jesus Christ established.
Mario, I hope that was helpful to you. You know what? When we get these questions in like this, you go through them pretty quick. I mean, you even murdered me a couple times, and I still have time for another question.
No, one of those was manslaughter at best. I think both of those. I think one time it was murder, but I think with the car, if I went to court, the first time you get off, I think, yeah, both of those. I think
you
barely
harvested my organs. That's while I was alive. That's murder.
That was murder. You weren't alive. We had the dignity to kill you first. My goodness, Cy, come on. But for Cy and Guy, the twin jogger car rolling, at best, you're going to get me on reckless indifferent to life. You're not getting me for murder.
I'm still dead either way.
You give me Manslaughter 3. I'll take Manslaughter 3.
Merry Christmas. Trent's killing
five,
me again.
5 years. Years with time served.
Nothing gets time me served. In the Christmas spirit like Trent murdering me and then arguing for lenience from the court.
Murder is a prejudicial term here, Cy. At best, you've only shown manslaughter. You've only shown homicide. Okay? Let's not poison the jury.
Trent has a new
book. Which we could also do for a thought experiment.
Trent's new book is called Salvation is from the Catholic Church, How Christ Uses the Church to Bring Us to Him. I should have mentioned it while he was giving that last answer.
For example, Cy, if I did something horrible, even like kill you, I could go to confession and I could find salvation because God desires the salvation of all people.
You know if you killed me, I would want you to do that. I would want you to find salvation.
That is good. Yeah. That is good. That shows that you are in a state of grace because you have the love of God in your heart and you don't seek vengeance. You seek the good of others.
Oh, I was just saying it to sound good on radio. All right, we got to take a quick break.
And you better go to confession.
Trent Horn is our guest. Merry Christmas. We got lots more questions from his patrons coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Do you have what it takes to defend your Catholic faith? The work of apologetics takes study, practice, and skill, but more than anything, it takes spiritual strength. The Soul of Apologetics, a new prayer resource from Catholic Answers, gives you the spiritual tools every Catholic apologist needs: prayers, meditations, and scripture-based reflections to build up the interior life. Order your copy of The Soul of Apologetics today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Trent Horn's our guest. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for being here with us. We're taking questions. Well, we've got the questions. I've got them in front of me from his patrons, people who support his Council of Trent podcast, certainly one of the most popular Catholic podcasts anywhere on the planet Earth, but I would also say one of the most popular and referred to and talked about podcasts anywhere being done by anyone. Well worth it. You should check it out. Go to councilofTrent.com. That's the easiest place to find it. Well, maybe you're good at finding stuff. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can go to YouTube and watch it on Trent's YouTube channel. As I said, all the questions are from patrons of that podcast, and this one comes from Emmanuel Cruz. Emmanuel wants to know, do you have any recommendations on trying to evangelize family members who are atheists?
Sure. And I would say it is important to remember that apologetics and evangelism are not synonyms. They are not the same thing. Apologetics and evangelism, really, they're distinct tools. Apologetics is often a subset of evangelism, but they're very distinct. You can evangelize someone without engaging in apologetics. Like if someone used to be Catholic, but has left the faith, fallen on hard times, just telling them, hey, look, God loves you. He hasn't forgotten about you. He has a plan for your life, and you won't regret going back to God, asking for forgiveness, going to the sacrament of confession, receiving him in the Eucharist, and going to church. God loves you. Go there and just talk to him, and you won't be, you know, you won't be disappointed. Just to appeal to someone like that, that's engaging in evangelism. I mean, well, it's bringing someone who's fallen away. Evangelism technically would be sharing the good news of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, especially to people who are unbaptized. But in the looser sense of the word, you're evangelizing. And you don't have to maybe do a defense. The person might just need a spiritual kick in the pants. But apologetics, you could do that. Even someone who fully believes the faith, you say, hey, you know, you're troubled by this. Let me give you some reasons to help you with that. So when it comes to evangelizing atheist family members, a lot of it isn't so much having the best arguments, which are important to have, but having just like the right kind of mannerism. St. Paul in Letter to the Corinthians says, if I have all knowledge, but I don't have love, I'm a resounding gong. So I think what you can do is just be inviting, like inviting them to Catholic functions where, you know, maybe not a mass if they want to go. Say, hey, do you want to come to mass with me? Well, I'm an atheist. Why would I go? Oh, you know, especially like Christmas mass, for example, or to Easter, just to come with and, you know, to see what it's like, or to an event at your parish that's a bit more maybe low stakes and not as liturgical, what we would call pre-evangelization. When it comes to having conversations, not trying to beat somebody in a debate, but just like asking them questions, saying like, okay, you know, so if you're an atheist, do you think there is no God, or you think there's, you don't have a good reason to believe in God? So it's more of an, I don't know, like asking questions and then saying, you know, what do you think about, these are things like sharing your testimony to say, hey, these are the things that I find really interesting that point to God for me. What would you think of that? So once again, you're not debating the person. You're asking them what they think. You're sharing your testimony. And in sharing your testimony, maybe you're sharing an argument you find compelling. Maybe you could share a debate with them and say, hey, you want to watch this debate and see what you think of it? Like the debate I had with Alex O'Connor on atheism back on Pints with Aquinas many years ago. That was a really good debate. Say, what do you think about this? That's another route. But ultimately, you want to keep the door open, pray for the person, be inviting, and just be open to God wherever the role you're going to have with that person. Maybe you aren't the one that's going to make the light bulb go off for them, but you plant a seed that somebody else will water and will flourish. But pray for them, offer, just as I said, just try to keep the door open when you're engaging these conversations, and you don't want to rush things. Just treat them with the dignity they have as a person.
Emmanuel, thank you very much for your support of Trent and for your question. This one comes from another patron of Trent Horn's podcast, Rachel Perez, and Rachel asks this. Hi, Trent.
Hello, Rachel.
What? I feel like I have to do that part. I need to get the response from you. What does Pope Leo's statement on not using the title of Mary as co-redemptrix mean for the direction of the church? Why was that statement important? As a new convert, I am unsure of the importance of the Mater Populi Fidelis letter, and I wondered if you could help me understand.
Sure. So the letter itself, it comes from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, the DDF, previously the CDF, previously the Holy Office. I love AKA, AKA. So it comes from there. And Cardinal Fernandez, the head of the DDF, has clarified the meaning of this document. And it's doctrinal notes on what kind of language the church uses in reference to Mary. And he was very clear that the church has not put out some kind of a ban on lay Catholics describing Mary with terms like co-redemptrix, which is a term that has been used previously. Popes have used it, theologians have used it to describe Mary's unique role in God's plan of redeeming the world, that her cooperation with God, cooperating with God in the Annunciation by saying yes and freely allowing herself to bear the Son and giving up her maternal rights so that her Son would die on the cross, to redeem the world, she cooperated with God's plan to redeem humanity. But that does not mean that she redeemed humanity in the same way that Christ did, so that they are both equally redeemers, or Mary is not another redeemer, as one Reformed Baptist apologist likes to claim in a book he wrote about Mary many, many years ago that I've responded to in my own works. So it's not like if you call Mary co-redemptrix at home when you're praying, it's not like the Pope Mobile is going to show up at your house with blue and red lights flashing and they're going to burst down your door and the Inquisition is going to show up and discipline you. Though I imagine if they did show up, though, I hope the siren, though, it would not be the normal siren. It would be the European police siren. Wee! You know, the European ones. I'm always like, is Jason Bourne on the run? What is going on here? I hear the European police sirens. Because it has to be for the Pope Mobile. No, but the document does say, though, that for the purposes of ecumenism, for the purposes of not creating unnecessary doctrinal barriers, the term is not going to be used in official church documents, in documents promulgating the teaching of the church. And that's important because the term itself, it can be so often misunderstood. If a term can be misunderstood so easily, and it's not strictly necessary to preserve an important dogma. So, for example, the term Theotokos, or to calling Mary the Mother of God, is a dogmatic term, a term that is used. Many Protestants misunderstand it. But the clarification of that term, I would say, is well worth it because it secures a very central and key truth of the faith, that not all doctrines are equally weighted. There is what is called a hierarchy of truth. So, for example, Christ rising from the dead is more essential faith, a more essential article of faith than Christ ascending into heaven. While Christ ascending into heaven is important, Christ rising from the dead, if Christ is not risen, your faith is in vain, as Paul would say. So there's going to be some truths that are more central, and as we go out more, there are going to be ones that are less central. So the truth that Jesus is God is a really central truth to the Christian faith. If you deny that, you're not Christian. So saying Mary is the mother of God is an integral element of upholding that Christ was divine throughout his entire life. He didn't just come to become divine later at his baptism, as some heretics said in the early church. But the term co-redemptrix causes even more confusion than the term Mother of God, and there isn't as central of a doctrine that is necessary to secure in using that term, namely the doctrine that Mary participated in a special way with Christ in Christ's redemption of the world. So it's not worth it to cause all of this undue hardship and misunderstandings and barriers to outreach to non-Catholics in that circumstance. So I hope that's helpful. And also, my colleague Joe Heschmeyer, I think, has a whole episode about this on his channel, Shameless Popery, that I would commend you to watch if you would like some more on that.
Thanks. Check that out, Rachel. Thanks very much. We'll take a quick break right back with more questions from patrons for Trent Horn on this Boxing Day on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1961. Rome grants Mother Angelica permission for an Alabama foundation. To honor her promise to God and with all the right approvals in place, Mother leaves her Ohio convent to found Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Irondale, Alabama, which has a Catholic population of 2%.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Trent Horn's our guest. It's kind of a relaxed feel. I hope you're relaxed wherever you are. Thanks for joining us on this day after Christmas. And we got all the questions are in. They're from patrons of Trent's show. shameless Trentery. No, what's it called? It's called Council of Trent. Council of Trent. You can find it at councilofTrent.com. You can find out all about it. This question comes from one of your patrons named Skabanik. Skabanik. How do you think I'm doing with that? Skabanik?
S-K-Banik?
Okay. Oh, all right. That might even better. Oh, this is a hard question. Settle in. How's Laura?
Oh, thank you for asking. Laura and I always joke that there is a particular sort of cadence that young, attractive girls of a certain socio-demographic will say when they say thank you. It doesn't always come off as being really genuine. It's almost a little Valley Girlish. So a lot of times we'll do stuff and we'll say, "Oh, thank you." So imagine this particular 19-year-old college girl, certain demographic and social status, her Starbucks in hand, trying to be polite but not really, and say, you know, so the response is, "Oh, thank you," and then trying to like leave the situation. So that is my my reply to that. Genuine thank you for asking. It's getting there. That is my reply. It is getting there.
Okay.
It was my wife was diagnosed with a tumor, brain cancer, back in May. Then she underwent surgery to remove the tumor in July. And it's been a hard road, but she's really come a long way. The tumor was around her speech center. It was like, I don't know, like an inch by inch and a half or an inch by half an inch. It was not tiny, not huge, thankfully. We caught it early. So it was removed. We did the pathology report on it, and it seemed to be basically like a grade two, like something that almost a grade one, something where you wouldn't have to really worry about it. There's always still risk it could come back, but we got the most favorable diagnosis from it. But that said, though, when you take away parts of somebody's brain, weird things will happen. Like when she was first in the hospital after the surgery, I feel like she had maybe 100 or 200 words at best, maybe 100. I don't know. There was a lot she could not say. She could not say my name. She could only say my husband. She couldn't say our children's names. It was very hard for her to communicate. Oh, yeah. It was rough. We had to use, she couldn't write either. So we had to use a lot of sign and we were basically playing charades for 2 weeks. And now I would say her speech is mostly back, but she has to speak much slower. Not much, but what's nice is she usually talked at 1.5 speed for YouTube. Now she's around back. Now she's really talking more at one. She's at one. So that works out well.
Okay, good.
Actually for her. So she has to, it's just a lot more difficult. She has to really put a lot more effort into speaking now. She gets lightheaded. So prayers for her, you don't feel well. You don't feel well when stuff's wrong with your brain. So that's just been a long-term thing. We're praying it's not going to be something chronic for her. And you know what? It's just hard. Once the kids are back, you're on duty again. They went to her parents' house for a few weeks. We've got 10, 8, and 5-year-old boys, so the house can be a little chaotic sometimes. But prayers are appreciated, and I think everyone's prayers have been really, really helpful for us and for me, because I've got to still go to work and carry the load and be there when she's not feeling well, and it's a journey. I feel like I'm rambling so much here, Si. There's a great skit. I think Brent Pella does this skit about MMA post-fight interviews. Like the guy who does the MMA fight and he comes out, he's been hit in the head so many times, he can't give a coherent answer. So he's always like, "So how do you think the fight went?" "Well, I went out there and I went to fight and I'm a winner. And I went, I did it, and I'm here for it, and I'm a winner, Jay." It's like the blood starts rolling down. So
I think you're doing a little better than that.
A little bit.
And you so are a winner. Ty,
I'm a winner. And yeah, just came out here for all that, and I'm a winner.
So.
I am a winner. I get to be married to Laura. She's
that's
so funny.
Right. That's right. And she's the beloved member of that pairing. Even the many, many people who don't like you, I think they do like Laura.
I have seen numerous comments like these online. I have seen comments, people saying, "I can't stand Trent Horn. His wife, Laura, is funny though." So I'm like, well,
I didn't even know you checked my comments. That makes me feel better that you actually read those things. I mean, I take the time to write them, and you don't. Right. That's nice to know that you read them.
your Fleetwood Mac lover, 1985.
Yeah, right. All right, here's a question from Loretta. I had to fight it off, Trent. I don't know if you could feel it. I had to fight it off. How many times do you think people have said, get back Loretta to her? How many times do you think that that has happened in her life? And I just didn't do it. I fought it. It wanted to come out so bad.
It is a hazard. And when you name, it is really hard that now when you name children and do things, you have to just, it's not just like movie quotes and things like that. It's like memes. You have to be so careful what you name your children.
Like, can you name a girl Karen anymore? I mean, people have been really mean about that. And there's a lot of lovely Karens in the world. Like, people named Karen in the world. But Karen.
I think we're going to see there's going to be this tremendous drop off. It's sort of like how there was this Cambrian explosion in 1985 of the name Madison for girls.
Oh, yeah.
Because the movie Splash came out. There's going to be like an apocalyptic decline of the name Karen after like some viral videos went out in like 2018. And we just see
there's that complete drop off.
Declining demographic.
So this one comes from Loretta, who does not need to get back home. And she says, hi, Trent.
Hello, Loretta.
What do you think a pastor of a parish can do to keep his college-bound parishioners from straying from the Catholic faith?
I think what he should do is the opportunities he has to serve the same way you would serve the community as a whole, being present. I think especially when preaching homilies, avoiding the temptation to just preach banality, to preach just like the generic, let's all be nice people homily. I mean, how many homilies have you heard that's always sort of boils down to, well, we're Catholics, so let's be nice. And, you know, let's try harder, everyone. That just shouldn't sound like, you know, just the same generic encouragement coach gave after practice. Because I think young people, especially, they want to be challenged. They want to hear even hard truths, but to hear that pastor really is concerned about that. That's why also I read an article recently, Si. I want to get your take on this. I think it was a deacon or someone, I'm trying to remember who wrote it. It was a suggestion for Pope Leo to amend canon law. I think it's canon law on this point, not the germ. Canon law says that priests are, maybe it's the germ, I can't remember, the general instruction of the Roman Missal, but that priests are strongly urged to give a homily at a daily mass if there's a sufficient number of people. And the recommendation was that it should be changed to permitted. So that way a priest would not feel a sense of guilt like they got to do a homily every single day at a daily mass, when in a lot of cases it's not really needed. And it would free up the priest's workload to maybe focus on, I mean, Protestant pastors, they spend all week on a blockbuster Sunday sermon, you know?
Yeah.
But Catholic priests, they've got so many more things to juggle when they're preaching, when they're teaching the faith, when they're serving the community, along with everything a priest does, house calls, sacramental visits, last rites, managing a school usually. So I think that would be one thing. Before we continue with Loretta's question, though, I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I have to say, Trent, I do think, like, when people think synodality is a bad word, and people are very like, what does synodality even mean, and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things it could mean, if we chose it, like, you have to choose what you're going to, you know, make a word mean when it's a new thing like that, is that parishes could be profound. You know, they always talk about the priest should listen more and all that. And all that stuff seems so amorphous and everything. But I think, I don't know about the homily at mass, but priests are doing so many things that you actually don't need a priest to do, that should just be taken over by the laity. A lot of the administrative stuff, a lot of the financial stuff, the priest should be there to govern all of that, but he shouldn't be doing it. And I think that would be
100%.
That would be 100%. A kind of positive synodality, in my view.
I wish that parishes had a chief operating officer. We have that at Catholic Answers.
Some do, yeah. but I think priests need to be more empowered, or maybe even not empowered, but maybe bishops need to be more insistent with them. I don't want you doing this. You have sacramental responsibilities. You have all these other things. I don't want you doing X, X, and X.
Like, I would love if the priest were the one who taught RCIA, for example.
Yes, exactly, Trent. Right.
He does that. Or he's freed up to me with the youth group. So to go back to Loretta's question about college-bound parishioners, like there I want the, you know, a priest freed up so he can better serve them, so he could go spend time for a college youth group. And I think that's hard for college, especially to have. Now, it's interesting. When I was in college, our youth group was really the other college students who were the leaders of the high school youth group that would mentor the high school students. So we had kind of a built-in thing. But to have something like that for young people, and to keep the age range a little bit narrower, not 18 to 39, that's kind of broad, but to have college and post-college, to have a group dedicated to that, this also comes up too for college-bound parishioners. Like, let's say young men. Like, how do you get young college-age men to go to a men's group? You know how you get college-age men to not go to a parish men's group? You have the parish men's group meet at Saturday at 6:30 in the morning.
Wait, college guys love to get up at 5:30 exactly. on Saturday morning.
But that's the problem.
Yeah,
we need, but we need like a group to say, yeah, a men's group. And I would love for college age Catholic men, yeah, be a part of our men's group. Come and learn about, you know, masculinity and to grow in your faith. But if it's but I know why we do it. We do it at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday because that's the least disruptive time for dad to be out of the house when kids are at home. Mm-hmm. Because weeknights, you take dad away at like 7 o'clock on a Thursday. You know, it's that's a bridge too far for many people, and understandably so.
Sure.
But I know I've been to parishes where they have a great young adult men's group, and that's when they meet Thursdays at 7 p.m. because that's when the guys are free. They're not at class anymore. They're off the clock at work or whatever they're doing. That's when they can meet. So to have that and to reaffirm them. So I think that especially having, like, we talk about youth ministry for high school students. I'd be more apt to have high school students do family ministry with their parents involved. I talked about this at Eric Sammons, but have dedicated youth ministry, but it's for people in college. And so that's where we have Focus. We have Newman Centers. So I think the pastor working with Focus, Fellowship of Catholic University students, working with the Newman Center, Newman Society, even if they're not like near a college campus, having something like that, I think, can also be very helpful. But you got to see where they're coming from and meet the needs, meet their particular needs where they are at in their 20s, you know?
I'm going to say thank you to Loretta for the question, because I want to get another one in here. And I'm going to go to Eric Alvarez, your supporter, because I think you have time to answer this one, Trent. Hi, Trent.
Hello, Eric.
What basic book of theology do you recommend? Thanks.
Sure. A really good... Now, at the start, I would say the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or the Compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is always a great thing to read to understand Catholic teaching laid out systematically. If you'd like a very good book on theology more than apologetics, though it has apologetics in it, I would recommend The Light of Christ, An Introduction to Catholicism by Thomas Joseph White. So I think that is a book that has been praised by a lot of people for presenting an approachable, systematic overview of Catholic theology. Because many people, like how I said before, Cy, that evangelism and apologetics are not the same thing. Theology and apologetics are not the same thing. Apologetics is a subset of theology. It's a rational defense of the Christian faith. Theology are just truths about God, truths about divine revelation. So you can do a lot of theology, and many people misunderstand this side. They'll become Catholic or they'll return to the faith, and all they do to grow in their faith is they just study apologetics, which is a good thing to have, but you're missing out on a lot of things to grow in your faith, to learn and grow and to be deeper and more mature, is really learning more about theology, learning about these deeper truths about God, about Christ, about the saints, about Mary and her intercession, about the sacraments, about grace, theology. Very, very important and fun, because I do apologetics all the time. Very stressful. Theology, really fun to delight in. So I would recommend that.
Eric, thank you very much for the question. Thanks for everybody who supports Trent and what he does over at the Council of Trent. Check it out, councilofTrent.com, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Trent's brand new book. I mean, brand new book, Salvation is from the Catholic Church, How Christ Uses the Church to Bring Us to Him. Trent Horn, Merry Christmas to you, Laura, and all the kids. Thanks very much. Did we lose Trent?
I'm right here, sir.
Still here. Merry Christmas. We lost you for a second.
Merry Christmas. All right. I
thought you were
Merry
a Scrooge
Christmas
there for a minute.
Well,
all right. See you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.